transmitting live from the heart of Times Square on 99.5 FM, WBAI New York, Pacifica Radio for the Tri-State Area. This is Trump Watch, a weekly series examining how President Donald J. Trump and his administration are changing the world we live in. I'm your host, Jesse Lent. Conrad
Tokyo. Many more countries are developing a capability to replicate what the Russians had done.
You alluded to making sure all the elements of the federal government should be working together. Do you have a suggestion on a strategy to do that to counter this disinformation?
Not overarching it.
Is this, in your investigation, did you think that this was a single attempt by the Russians to get involved in our election, or did you find evidence to suggest they'll try to do this again?
No, it wasn't a single attempt. They're doing it as we sit here, and they expect to do it during the next campaign.
That was former special counsel Robert Mueller speaking to Congressman Will Hurd of Texas of the House Intelligence Committee earlier today, the second of two congressional committees Mueller testified before. Footage courtesy of CBS News. The exchange between Mueller and Hurd was one of a precious few moments of Mueller's testimony where the current state of election security in the U.S. was brought up. Hello and welcome to Trump Watch. Tonight on the show, we're going to take a look at just how safe or unsafe our voting systems are and what can be done to protect them with Adam Pior, author of the July 23rd Newsweek article, Russia is using Cold War strategy to undermine the faith of Americans in the 2020 election, will it work? And Christopher DeLuzio, legal and policy scholar of the University of Pittsburgh Institute for Cyber Law, Policy and Security, and co-author of the new report from the Brennan Center for Justice, Defending Elections, Federal Funding Needs for State Election Security. Hello, Adam. Hello, Chris. Welcome to Trump Watch. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Jesse. How are you?
Adam, you describe in your article how the Russian cyber attacks on our election system in 2016 and 2018 are an example of agitpop, a blending of the words agitation and propaganda that was a preferred method of the KGB of KGB agents during the Cold War. How so?
During the Cold War, most of our intelligence officers spent their time gathering intelligence, but intelligence officials for the KGB and other Russian services were required to spend about 25% of their time doing agitprop, which was coming up with ways to, spread false, what we now call fake news, and sowing divisions in different places that served the USSR's interests. So the most famous example of that is in the 80s, they managed to convince most of Africa that the AIDS virus had been created by the CIA in a CIA lab. And they started by inserting this in a newspaper in India, and gradually it spread throughout the world, and eventually Dan Rather even reported on the rumors. So that's sort of the case study that people talk about in the 80s. And of course, Vladimir Putin was a KGB officer, so he spent 25% of his time doing this. So this is very much in the tradition of that, what they're doing on social media, and all designed to divide us, to amplify the divisions that already exist, make people angry, and undermine our faith in democracy.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's where you talk about vulnerabilities in the, the voting system. That would be the incentive to do that, to undermine our faith in the legitimacy of our elections, which is at the heart of our democracy. And it's something they've done in other countries, and most people expect them to do that here in the next election.
Right. The government, the U.S. government, that is, has kept the official figures or the information about the extent of whether that tampering from the Russians affected the outcome of the election. But you point out in your article that for Russians, at least those behind the hack, that wasn't the point. It was just if people are questioning the election. Do I have that right?
Yeah, rightly so. I guess there's so much emphasis on whether Trump and his campaign obstructed justice and attempted to collude, but it's definitely obscured the larger point, which is, a lot of people say that that Putin had a personal animosity towards Hillary Clinton and definitely wanted to help Donald Trump because it would advance their interests. But that was more a secondary purpose of this. You know, the main point was to undermine our faith in democracy.
Based on that agitprop criteria, it's not
right.
It's hard not to see the Russian efforts as successful.
Yeah, I mean, we've been yelling at each other over the Mueller inquiry since Trump got into office. You know, people are very angry on both sides. And to a certain extent, they've questioned the legitimacy of his election. But the fear is that it'll be much worse in terms of, there hasn't been as much focus on voting machine irregularities, even though there have been worse some problems in 2016 and 2018, as just the fact that Russia, you know, exacerbated tensions and helped him in other ways. And, you know, by hacking into, you know, releasing Podesta's emails and stuff like that. And, you know, that serves the same purpose, to undermine our faith in democracy. It seems hard to believe that people in the Kremlin wouldn't be smiling right now.
Chris,
who are behind this.
Chris, for your report from the Brennan Center, you focused on six states: Alabama, Arizona, Illinois, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Pennsylvania, to demonstrate voting issues or vulnerabilities in our voting system nationwide. The main issues you found appeared to be computers too old to even have basic virus protection on them, antivirus protection software that I think anyone with a laptop or a desktop computer would be familiar with. How much do you believe the issue of election interference could be solved by making simple, long overdue upgrades to equipment?
Well, those kinds of upgrades are what I consider a necessary first step, but they're not a panacea. So if you take a state like Pennsylvania, for instance, which uses or had been using paperless electronic voting systems called DRE machines, or direct recording electronic systems, in the most recent 2018 midterms, more than 80% of Pennsylvania voters were voting on those machines. While they're vulnerable to hacking, they're more prone to technological error, they're a real threat to security of the vote and public faith therein. So, of course, the first step is to replace those. And efforts are underway there in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. But that's not enough, right? Even if you have the paper ballots and you have more secure voting systems themselves, you must also bring things like mandatory post-election audits after every election and every race. You have to be taking the steps to have paper backups of things like electronic poll books that are in use in the polling places or precincts. You've got to be investing in protecting your voter registration systems and other pieces of the election architecture. So I make the point that although there's a lot of attention around voting systems and the need to replace them, which is quite dire in many places in this country, it's not enough. And so there are things states need to be doing beyond that. And part of this report that the Brennan Center, Pitt Cyber, R Street, and the Alliance for Securing Democracy put together was to highlight that even for states that have a substantial need to replace machines, the federal money is a drop in the bucket toward doing that, and that there are needs beyond that which we just aren't touching with federal money yet. So we need to be making investments at the national level to help states shore up our democracy.
Why do you think it took such a major calamity like the Russian interference in 2016 to even get to this point? Why are these election systems so out of date in basically every state that you looked at?
I think there's some sense of folks don't pay attention to problems until there are problems. And it's not to say that the vulnerabilities around these machines haven't been known in election security community and elsewhere. They have. But I think the public recognition now about what Russian efforts were in 2016 have brought the issue to the forefront and are now focusing on the public's attention and policymakers' attention on the critical question of, well, what do we do now? How do we shore up our democracy and our voting systems? And that's key.
Adam, President Trump has clearly not been fond of discussing Russian hacking, with Politico reporting that at a press conference in 2016, after meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, he said at a press conference, quote, Putin said he didn't meddle, adding, every time he sees me, he says I didn't do that. And I really believe that when he tells me that, he means it. Yet it would be difficult to argue that the Democrats have made election security a central issue. Why do you think it's been so difficult for a seemingly bipartisan issue like election security to get any significant political traction?
Well, I mean, it depends on which component of election security you're talking about. I want to make one point just that I read an article last week. I mean, the Associated Press came out with an article showing that the Pennsylvania system and a lot of the other systems are operating using Windows 7, which, you know, to create ballots, which soon Microsoft will no longer be providing security patches for. So that's another problem. But anyways, that's just a parenthetical there. But in terms of it's just politically, it's difficult to talk about election security, in part because the elections are administered by on the county level. By, you know, tens of thousands of local and county and state officials. And so they sort of jealously guard that. And it's kind of a state's right type thing. They don't want federal interference so much. And also my understanding is that the voting machine manufacturers and the electronic registration manufacturers are a very powerful political lobby. I've read a bunch of articles written by other journalists about sort of the revolving door politics that go on between county officials and these companies. So there's a lot of political resistance and the urgency hasn't been there. And I don't know, election, if you get into the nuts and bolts of voting machine security, it's kind of hard to make it that interesting or to sustain it over multiple articles. So that might be part of it. I mean, it's a lot easier to scream about, you know, partisan, you know, the Democrats trying to push impeachment and Trump colluding with the Russians. So it's been overshadowed, I think, by the politics. I don't know why it's been so politicized on both sides.
But it's not as sexy a story when you start talking about voting machines.
Yeah.
Chris, I want to jump. Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying in my Newsweek story, it was kind of a teaser at first until I found people who could describe what it was like to be at the center of these calamities unfolding on election day or to have their emails hacked or, you know, if when you talk to the people who've been involved, it's obviously a dramatic thing, but it's hard to sustain that.
And you report that it wasn't just election, you know, workers from boards of elections. There were also people at the actual voting machine company who had their emails hacked, or at least there are some reports implying that.
Right. I think the Mueller report found that at least the malware was installed on at least one major voting registration, you know, like e-registration company's server, and many of their clients received phishing emails from them after that. So there was active attempts to penetrate.
I want to jump back to your first point, Adam. Chris, I believe it was your report from the Brennan Center and a couple other agencies, as you mentioned, this joint report that actually broke that bit of reporting about Pennsylvania just having basically the voting system running on machines that had to be PCs with Windows software that will soon be non-existent, at least in the sense of getting any patches or updates. How wide a problem do you think that is? And is this a soon-to-be-resolved issue, or is this a persisting problem?
Well, it's hard to know. You know, Adam correctly points out there was Associated Press reporting on this exact issue. And part of the problem for voting systems is the federal certification regime, which by the way, is voluntary at the federal level. Many states have made it mandatory. But that regime, number one, applies only to voting systems. And so it doesn't touch the other elements of our election infrastructure. But that regime is a pretty lengthy and voluminous process with testing and a variety of things. And so things like changing software and patching and updates can affect a voting system certification and may perhaps require a voting system vendor to seek, you know, recertification or certification of a newer software configuration. And so it's not an easy answer to slap a Band-Aid onto an existing operating system for something that's touching the voting machines. So it will be a problem for, I suspect, many jurisdictions as they contend now with software that's likely going to be not maintained, if we believe the reporting, going forward or soon to come.
I'm speaking with Adam Pior of Newsweek and Christopher DeLuzio of the Brennan Center for Justice. You're listening to Trump Watch. My name is Jesse Lent. Chris, your report for the Brennan Center mentions the $380 million Congress allocated to the states as part of the Help America Vote Act last year, but that, to put it bluntly, there just isn't enough money to solve the vast problems in the U.S. election system. What are some of the areas that most need resources beyond what the Help America Vote Act has provided?
Well, I'll push back a little bit on the idea that there isn't enough money to go around. So $380 million is what Congress gave to the states in 2018 for election security. That's less money than what the Pentagon spent in recent years on military bans. So it's a question of priorities to me. Number two, I think that if you take a look at, say, Pennsylvania and what its needs are just to replace its voting systems. So Pennsylvania's share of that $380 million is, with a state match, roughly $14 million. We'll call that maybe 10 to 12% of the statewide bill in Pennsylvania to replace its voting systems. So there's a huge funding gap there, and that doesn't even get to addressing some of the other things that a state like Pennsylvania and many others would want to do, like shoring up voting registration system, engaging in regular cybersecurity assessments and trainings for the county or in some states, town officials who run elections. We saw a program in Illinois, for example, that we highlighted in the report, a cyber navigator program, which could be helpful to a lot of states. In essence, you have a dedicated cybersecurity expert with geographic responsibility within a state, helping local election officials identify vulnerabilities, solutions to patch them up, and otherwise monitoring with the expertise one would need the vulnerabilities in a jurisdiction. And so those are the kinds of things we want to see funded and that Congress ought to help state and local election officials do. And frankly, given the threat here, we're talking about nation-state adversaries, it's not a fair fight to have our state and local officials be our frontline cyber warriors.
To be clear, what I meant by there isn't enough money is that the $380 million allotment is not enough money to solve these problems. Are you saying that the additional funding needs to come from the federal level, the state level, some combination of both? Who do you think really needs to step up here?
I think it should be some combination of both. And certainly the states have a substantial role in administering our elections. They are the lead officials. And by the states, I, of course, include local officials at the county or town level, depending on the state, who really run the nuts and bolts of our elections. But given the threats here, and these are sophisticated nation-state adversaries who have, and if we listen to Mr. Mueller's testimony, FBI Director Wray's testimony the day before yesterday, there are ongoing nation-state efforts to interfere in our elections. To me, that's a national crisis and an obligation that ought to fall on the Congress to help the states defend our democracy.
Right. Adam, in the clip we heard at the top of the show, Robert Mueller mentions that other countries will attempt to copy Russia's hacking efforts. Do you have any idea which countries or which efforts he could be referring to there?
Well, probably Iran, I would think. I don't think they like Trump very much. I don't know. People often lump in North Korea. Those are the two that come immediately to mind, but, could be anybody. Everybody's watching, and it's not that hard, what the payoff is. But Iran and North Korea are two of the most formidable hacking armies, I would think, besides Russia.
We've been talking
largely. And China, of course.
Right. We've been talking largely about the broad issue of election hacking. But what are some of the more concrete ways, or especially some of the ways we haven't seen before, that Russia, you expect, will use to affect our elections in 2020?
Well, a lot of people are alarmed by the emergence of so-called deep fakes, right? I mean, there was this footage. It wasn't a very good one, but it was footage of Nancy Pelosi. I think somebody, put her head on another body, and she was slurring her words and look kind of drunk, and it was very low tech, but technology exists to make much more convincing deep fakes. And as Adam Schiff talked about, you can think back to the election with Mitt Romney, where he made those comments in the private fundraiser about, you know, I forget what percent it was because it was so long ago now, but
the 47%, I think it was.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The 47%. I mean, you can imagine that could be doctored up and somebody could make something like that and we'll start to, it could be very damaging. And so that's something that people are anticipating and worried about. And, you know, I don't know how we're going to do that, but I also was just, I don't know, profoundly alarmed by just digging into the specifics of what we've been hearing about for months, which is just the use on social media. I mean, I talked to this woman named Kate Starbird, who doesn't really study politics much at all. She's at the University of Washington, and they were just studying Black Lives Matter and Twitter and which tweets spread. And after the House Intelligence Committee released a list of names and accounts associated with Russian intelligence on Twitter, they went back and looked, and all the most aggressive people were on that list, including on one side, they were advocating, on the Black Lives Matter side, they were advocating for people to shoot the police. And on the right, the conservative side, they were using racial epithets. And I don't know exactly how, I mean, Facebook and Twitter have been working hard, they say, to weed out this stuff, but it seems hard to believe they'll be able to do that, you know, completely. And YouTube is now, because of the deep fakes, going to be part of it. And they're really getting people angry to the extent that, you know, when I wrote this Newsweek story, it's getting tweeted and there's all sorts of nasty comments on both sides. And I'm thinking that's probably the Russians, you know. So that still worries me, I think. But I would say that deep fakes used in that kind of way on YouTube are one thing that people are worried about. And I think also, you know, you can ask Chris, but I think that people are expecting, you know, more aggressive attacks on our election infrastructure this time.
Chris, would you agree with that?
I think there's certainly an expectation that the worst is perhaps not behind us. Now, balanced against a greater recognition of the threat and the fact that there have been efforts in the past and there has been some improvement in voting systems and certainly the readiness of election officials and their federal counterparts to protect against attacks. But, you know, as Adam alluded to, attacks on election infrastructure itself, that was only one component of what we saw in 2016. There were, of course, hacks of campaigns and candidates, right? We saw the DNC. We saw John Podesta's emails make their way into the public domain. We also saw the kind of disinformation campaign, largely through social media, that, of course, existed with fake accounts, but engaged real Americans on social media and real Americans to come to actual events. So to me, there are those three buckets. And of course, there are tactics and procedures that might fit within several of them. But to just focus on one is to miss the big picture. And perhaps there are other ways we'll see in future elections where adversaries might try something else even to come in our election. So I think officials are certainly more, they're thinking more about these threats, but they're ever evolving. And I hope that we'll be ready for what comes next.
Yeah, I would add one more bucket, which former intelligence officials pointed out, which hasn't been talked about as much, which is dark money and efforts to pour money into campaigns. With Citizens United, disclosure requirements have changed greatly, right? So people can make independent expenditures like the NRA or something without revealing who the donors are. And that's an issue of great concern, which people identified as sort of a fourth bucket that they're very worried about. That where there can be more influence. If you get a willing organization or candidate that's willing to take that kind of money. And, you know, you can see in one of the Mueller indictments, after they hacked the DCCC, it says that one Republican congressman actually reached out to Guccifer, right, or whatever his name is, the Russian intelligence guy, and asked if he could give him information on his opponent. And Guccifer did. He shared that information. It hasn't been said who that was, but that's a concern. If there was, you know, there's these channels for active collaboration.
Thank you both so much.
Okay, thank you.
I've been speaking with Adam Pior, author of the July 23rd Newsweek article, Russia is using Cold War strategy to undermine the faith of Americans in the 2020 election. Will it work? And Christopher DeLuzio, legal and policy scholar of the University of Pittsburgh Institute for Cyber Law, Policy and Security, and co-author of the new report from the Brennan Center for Justice, along with several other organizations, entitled Defending Elections, Federal Funding Needs for State Election Security. You're listening to Trump Watch. My name is Jesse Lent. That's all for this week. Reggie Johnson engineered this program live. You can hear all 123 episodes of Trump Watch with Jesse Lent at soundcloud.com/TrumpWatchWBAI or wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again next week when we'll break down a different aspect of the Donald Trump administration. Until then, I'm your host, Jesse Lent. Talk to you next time.